Shrink Wrap Radio number 771, Dr. Daniel Siegel on interpersonal neurobiology and clinical practice.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest, Daniel J. Siegel, MD, is one of three editors of the new Norton book, Interpersonal Neurobiology and Clinical Practice, which we will be discussing. Dr. Siegel was previously my guest on episode number 255 on MindSight and episode number 534, Your Mind is Bigger Than Your Brain. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Daniel Siegel, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and thanks for having me here.
Yeah, well, I believe you've been on the show twice before. Once back in 2011, when we spoke about your book, MindSight, and 2016, when we discussed the mindful brain. So it's great to have you back on the show, and we're going to be discussing you write so many books so quickly, but I think it's one of your newest books, and it's Interpersonal Neurobiology and Clinical Practice, which is a compendium of chapters assembled by you, Dr. Alan Shore, and Dr. Louis Cozzolino. So what was the impulse for this collaboration?
Well, thank you. And I'll show the book so you and I don't have to keep on remembering to show it.
Here's show us the thickness of it as well.
Well, it's not that thick. It's, let's see. I mean, compared to books I write, but it's only 320 pages or something like that. 311 pages of beautiful writing by other writers, including the ones you mentioned as editors.
Yeah.
And then what we did was we invited many of the authors of our interpersonal neurobiology series. So the three of us, Alan Shore, Lou Cozzolino, and I have been working hard to try to create this interdisciplinary field called interpersonal neurobiology. And about 20 years ago, I was approached by Deborah Malmud at Norton to create a series which, you know, is all about this interdisciplinary way of understanding the mind and mental health. And then over the years, we now have over 75 textbooks. And this is a compilation from many of the authors of books in the series.
So 20 years ago, already it's been 20 years.
Been 20 years since the series first began. I think the first book, I invited Lou Cozzolino to write a book, and he wrote a book on, you know, basically the social brain and how a therapist can understand that. And it was the beginning of, you know, what was a series of books. I mean, literally, we have 75 textbooks, so I can't mention all the authors, but, you know, some of the ones, sadly, were no longer living, include Jaak Panksepp and Dan Stern, and a number of other people who I'm so glad we were able to invite them to write for the series. Yeah. And give us their wisdom before they moved on away from this life we're all leaving. And And this book, Interpersonal Neurobiology and Clinical Practice, is really exciting because it takes the hard-earned wisdom of these wonderful writers who are themselves either scientists or therapists or both, and it puts it in very succinct way the key messages that taking this interdisciplinary framework offers for us. And so it's a really exciting book. I was thrilled that the three editors, I'm the founding editor, but Alan Shore was a series editor, Lou Cozzolino is the series editor, where the three of us could, you know, be in this book as writers as well as editors for the writings of so many other people. And I could actually, you know, what I might do is I could read to you who's in the book, and you can just get from the title of the chapter, then we can even talk about each of the chapters. But one is called Interpersonal Neurobiology from the Inside Out. I wouldn't read that. That was...
That's the one by you.
That's the one by me. I'm just joking. Yeah. So that just kind of gives you a history of what was the impetus to try to create this interdisciplinary approach of not just the different disciplines of science, but, you know, all different ways of knowing, indigenous knowing, contemplative knowing, what we learned from studying music, poetry, arts, you know, that's what interpersonal neurobiology offers us. And as a way of approaching it as a mental health professional, it gives you a way of understanding work with individuals, but as well as working with public issues, like how we get along to try to promote social justice, how we can use the principles of interpersonal neurobiology to approach environmental challenges we have now, environmental destruction and climate change. So it gives you the big planetary view. Alan Shore writes the next article, The Interpersonal Neurobiology of Therapeutic Mutual Regressions in Reenactments of Early Attachment Trauma, which is a really powerful chapter on looking at how essentially implicit memory gets embedded early in our lives as patterns of interaction that later on can be enacted within the therapy relationship. So for a therapist to understand this deep way, Alan powerfully illuminates this interpersonal neurobiology view of therapy is very, very helpful. And of course, Alan has been a leader in understanding how attachment patterns shape us early on and then how those patterns continue to shape our reenactments and our emotional experiences later. So that's a very powerful chapter. The third chapter is by Lou Cozzolino and colleagues Carly Samuelson and Chloe Droulis, and that's called The Interpersonal Neurobiology of Executive Function. And executive function is the broad term we use for, you know, how people come to have something called self-regulation. So regulating your attention, emotion, mood, thought, behavior, even ways you decide in some ways how to live your life, you can see is related to executive function. So this is a really wonderful way a therapist can see the cutting edge of science behind executive function. And then the next article is, or chapter is by the scientist Stephen Porges, who's written a number of books in our series, as has Alan and Lou. And this is called The COVID-19 Pandemic is a Challenge to Our Nervous System, a Polyvagal Perspective. And Steve Porges is the founder of the polyvagal theory, which basically takes the way in which the 10th cranial nerve, the vagus nerve, can be understood as having two branches, a ventral branch, which is older and not myelinated, and a dorsal branch, which is myelinated. And the dorsal branch has a lot to do when we have a social engagement turned on and we connect with one another. But the ventral vagal branch gets activated when we feel a collapsing sense of despair and hopelessness. Mm-hmm. And when you add that to what Steve and I and Pat Ogden had these long conversations that I put in the Pocket Guide to Interpersonal Neurobiology, that it's not just fight and flight, and it's not even just fight, flight, and freeze, but it's four things. It's fight, flight, freeze, and faint. And the faint gets elaborated when you understand the ventral vagal nerve branch of the vagus nerve, the ventral branch of the vagus nerve. It's very much involved with allowing us to actually, I have it reversed. Let me reverse it. It's involved with the social engagement system, the ventral branch. It's the dorsal branch that's unmyelinated and is a part of what's called the dorsal dive, where you drop your blood pressure, you drop your heart rate. And this dorsal vagal response is activated when you feel threatened. So that is very different from the sympathetically driven, that is, the autonomic nervous system has the sympathetic, adrenaline-based, energy-consuming drive branch, and then it has the parasympathetic branch that slows things down, is energy-conserving. The freeze, when you talk about fight, flight, and freeze, freeze is actually very energy-consuming. You're tightening up your muscles, you're paralyzing yourself until you can figure out, do I fight or do I flee? And so in many ways, clarifying this is the brilliance of Steve Porges, that lets us look at how the dorsal branch of the vagus nerve is in this collapse, and the ventral branch is more modern and helps us engage. So rather than just simply saying, what's your vagal tone? I think the polyvagal theory allows us to see, as Steve points out in this article, that the challenges of COVID-19 are threat states that are activating us in many ways that get us to withdraw. So then the question is, how do we actually deal with that? And it's a very timely chapter.
I'm going to be interviewing him in a few weeks.
Oh, and, you have his chapter there. That'll take.
That'll help.
Yeah. And I think, Steve is a good example of, how interpersonal neurobiology has invited scientists like Steve to become an active part of the way we clinically think about the mind and how to understand therapy. Steve would be one example. Jaak Panksepp, who passed recently, he has written a couple of books in our series. One was The Archaeology of Mind. The other is with Lucy Bivin. The other is a book called something on personality. I forgot the other part of the phrase. I don't think, but it was with, I think it's John Davis. And together what they did was provide a deep understanding for us as clinicians of what is involved in the motivational systems that drive us, not just in our behavior, but also in the way that we feel and where we pay attention in our lives. So
I was lucky to interview him before he passed. So in some ways, this series of podcasts is an archaeology of psychology in this period of time.
Yeah. Well, that's beautiful. That's great, David. Yeah. I'm so glad you did, because Jaak, had so much to share. And I remember him very fondly. So the next article is by Kathy Steele, Understanding, it's called Beyond Attachment, Understanding Motivational Systems in Complex Trauma and Dissociation. And Kathy writes a really powerful article that helps us take the science of the mind and the brain and relationships, the basis of interpersonal neurobiology, and then look at the process of early trauma, how it affects the fragmentation of the mind to create dissociation from this disorganized attachment, and then to understand how the motivational systems that Jaak talked about, that we were just referring to, can really be used to see how our present moment experience can be shaped by these deep structures that got fractured because of attachment trauma. So that's a very powerful chapter as well. And then Bonnie Badenoch writes a chapter called Becoming a Therapeutic Presence in the Counseling Room and the World. And Bonnie, I remember when she first came to a study group of mine, probably over 20 years ago now. I remember when she first said, look, could I come see you? I want to share something with you. And she was running a trauma center. And she showed me this outline, like for a manual for the trauma treatment center. And I look at this manual and I said, Bonnie, you know, this is not a manual. She goes, what do you mean? I said, this is like a book that every therapist should read. And she, her eyes like almost popped out of her head. She goes, what are you talking about? I don't think she ever thought about writing a book. I mean, just like Lou Cozzolino hadn't thought about writing a book. And so I said to Bonnie, I said, you know, this manual shows really deep, intricate thinking that is built on science and shows practical clinical application.
Yeah.
So she said, okay, let me think about it. And, you know, she worked on it. And then I got her connected, you know, with Deborah Malamud at Norton. And, you know, and I worked with her to see how do you turn a manual into a book. And, you know, I never remember exactly how you say that. I think it's the Brainwise Therapist, something like that. But her first book was just a massive hit. And she's a wonderful clinician, wonderful person, and incredible writer. And now she's written a series of books for the series. Wow. Anyway, and this is a chapter that shows her thinking. To go from the personal to the planetary, I think, is so crucial for all of us in mental health. So that's Bonnie's really great
comment. I got to interview her, too, sometime back. Is she Australian? I seem to recall that she's Australian.
Bonnie, no. Bonnie's not Australian. She, okay, I don't think. I'm trying to, her accent isn't Australian. Maybe she was originally from there, but she has a, I don't want to say a West Coast accent, but West Coast States accent.
Okay. Yeah. I'm probably wrong about that.
Oh, maybe you're right. Then we go on to another, these are all authors in our series, Richard Chaffetz, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name right. I need to check that out with him. Called Humiliation is Not Just About the Intent to Shame and Degrade. So this is a deep dynamic view, and the subtitle is Some Facets of the Psychotherapy of Trauma Related to Humiliation. You know, and shame and humiliation are very, very potent, often not spoken about emotional states that obviously are deeply relational. You know, and then we carry them with us, you know, into life so that they affect not just our physiology, like a heaviness in the chest and a nausea in the belly and a turning away of eye gaze, but they impact our cognitive beliefs. And sometimes when the one way to think about it is when we need attunement and we don't get it, that lack of getting what we need leads to a shame state in the moment. And then there's a cognitive belief, if that's repeated, that we're no good, that the person we needed something from is fine. And the reason they didn't give it to us is that we're bad. And not, it's unlike guilt, you know, where you've done something wrong and you can correct your behavior. Shame is you are defective and there's nothing you can do. So when that's combined with anger, you know, shame can turn into humiliation. And in this chapter, Richard Chaffetz does this powerful job of looking at the details of psychotherapy and how we as therapists really need to be very aware of how these shame states and these states of humiliation can emerge and lead to a lot of negative reinforcement of the person's internal beliefs about being a dependent.
We've looked outward at other cultures and referred to them as shame-based cultures, right? And I don't think there's been a lot of thought or consideration about shame in our own Western frame. So I think this will open up some important new thinking.
I think so. And this chapter is also an invitation to think about what the Dalai Lama once said was, you know, someone was presenting from the United States, you know, some of what we face here, and they described self-hatred. And the Dalai Lama says to this person, what are you talking about? And they said, well, you know how people can tend to hate themselves. And he goes to the translator, what is he saying? And the translator had to say, in America, people hate themselves. And the Dalai Lama just goes, why would you hate yourself? It was like, and so in a culture where there's love and acceptance, it's like exactly the reverse of what you're saying, David. It's the opposite of a shame-based culture. there's a feeling like, you know, the way I am is fine. You know, now this is according to the Dalai Lama. You know, he was raised in a very special kind of way.
Yes,
from six on, you know, he was in this incredibly privileged position. So I'm not sure that that's the case, that in Dharamsala in India, where he ultimately moved to, or in Tibet, where he was from, you know, whether it's true that people don't have shame. It'd be really interesting from an anthropological point of view to see if people corrupt what His Holiness said.
Let me cut in for a minute to sing the praises of today's sponsor, MasterClass. I'm so thrilled to have MasterClass back as a sponsor again. I absolutely love MasterClass to the extent that I bought several subscriptions as gifts for family members. These are classes taught by world-class masters in their own fields. For example, I've already taken classes on poetry from poet laureate Billy Collins, and on songwriting from the very soulful Alicia Keys. Imagine my surprise and delight on discovering a recently added class on mindfulness by Jon Kabat-Zinn. I've never been able to attend one of his workshops, but he's the one everyone quotes, totally relevant to my work here. And he's offering a 20-lesson course on MasterClass, looking me or you right in the eye. The great thing is that the individual video lessons are each only 10 to 15 minutes, and you can watch them on whatever device you have, whether iOS, Android, desktop computer, Apple TV, Amazon Fire TV, or Roku. I mean, we're talking tons of video lessons from more than 100 of today's most brilliant minds, and they're available anytime, anywhere. An annual membership usually costs $180, which is already a bargain when you consider all the content you're getting. I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every MasterClass, and as a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, you get 15% off an annual membership. Go to masterclass.com/shrink. That's masterclass.com/shrink for 15% off MasterClass. Now, back to the interview. When I was looking through the chapters that you're sharing with us, the chapter titles, I was struck by the range and diversity, and there are titles and subjects in there that I think readers will be surprised to discover.
Yeah, well, this was, you know, when I wrote the foreword to the book, I wanted to point that out because, you know, people think of interpersonal neurobiology as only about something very specific to the practice of psychotherapy. And while it is true, it's grounded in that, you can apply many of the things across a very diverse set of topics, as this book reveals. Mm-hmm. And also the thing that I find really exciting is that the invitation in the framework of interpersonal neurobiology is to say, let's look at something in a deep way and look at its practical applications, and let's base it on science, and let's be open to how people have different ways of approaching this interpersonal neurobiology framework. So if we sat in a room with Bonnie Badenoch and Lou Cozzolino and Alan Shore and Kathy Steele and Pat Ogden, you and everyone else who we'll talk about soon, you know, the others, you'd find a different way of emphasizing things, maybe even a different way of interpreting things. And so we try to welcome debate and discussion and honor different ways of doing things. And so I was so thrilled that this chapter would have so much variation in it and really cover, not this chapter, this book of chapters, you know. And because each of these authors of the chapters is themselves an author of an entire book, we know as editors, Deborah Malmud as the publisher, myself as the founding editor of the series, Lou Cozzolino and Alan Shore as series editors, you know, that these folks can write really well. So you don't know the backstory, but there are a number of people who, you know, I myself as an editor have signed up to write books, and we've had to cancel their contracts because they really couldn't write.
Mm.
Yeah. And we said, you know, this is a wonderful effort. Thank you so much. This is not going to fly. You know, we're canceling the contract. So, and some of them are like, you know, dear people in my life, you know, so we've That's tried hard. To be, yeah, it's very hard. So it's a real exciting but demanding challenge to find someone who is both, well, not both, I would say three things, capable of really understanding the science across disciplines, seeing in practical ways how it applies to the practice of psychotherapy that then has other implications for education or parenting. Any ways you help the mind develop, for example, is really what we're about. So that's, of course, psychotherapy, but that's what you do in school. That's what you do as a parent. So this is why our books are used by people in those areas. And then you have the third issue is, can the person you're finding knows the science deeply across disciplines, sees the practical applications, and does have a way to express that? The third thing is, can they write?
It's a tall order because the vision, I had planned that we would do a deep dive in your chapter, and we may yet
get around.
Oh, we
can do that if you want. Yeah, I want to honor all the authors.
I'm glad that you're doing this, but comes across in your chapter is the breadth of your thinking as a pioneer of this area that extends out everywhere from the cosmos out to across multiple scientific disciplines and different levels of our being and neurological levels and social, and it's all about integration, etc. So we'll get there. Yeah. You keep going. But that's a tall order because you're challenging them to rise to the vision that you've laid out over 20 years. And
yeah,
a number of books.
Yeah, I mean, it's a vision that I hope is useful, number one. But also, it is like an invitation, you know, to rise to a certain level of a standard that Deborah Malmud, you know, is our publisher, and she's a leading, you know, editor at WW Norton. And we're very proud that our series is with Norton because they do have a very high standard. People don't realize this, but there are quite a few of my books where the first manuscript goes in and Deborah doesn't accept it.
Uh-oh.
And I'm the series editor.
Yeah. Wow.
So, and she says, here's why I'm not accepting it. 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, these are the reasons. I go, oh my gosh. And even the book I'm writing now, David, you know, is going in its fourth iteration. And I'm not exaggerating that. You know, this is the fourth full, complete book that I'm turning around this very difficult topic. But that's fine. Because I really believe in Deborah Malmud. I think she creates a high standard that is a part of why the interpersonal neurobiology series at Norton is so, you know, I don't want to say popular, but we have more books than any other mental health series, but that it's so well regarded because we are, you know, we are really careful about these three factors: scientific rigor, clinical practicality, and writing excellence. So that is a tall order. And I know, you know, for me, you know, years ago, I guess it would be now 30 years ago, when interpersonal neurobiology began, was when I was in a group of 40 scientists and really trying to find a way from mathematicians to anthropologists and everyone in between to see if we could find a common language across these independent disciplines. At the time, E.O. Wilson hadn't written his wonderful book, Consilience. But if I had had that term, I would have said to the group, we're doing consilience, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But he hadn't written the book yet. So we were trying to find a way to reach each other, to say, what is the mind? what's its connection to the brain? That was the only question, right? How do mind and brain relate to each other? But in the end, when you think about the cosmos as you're making this point, once you talk about the mind and consciousness, you start getting to some incredibly fascinating things about systems, the systems of the networks of the brain and the head, the networks within the whole body. Then you realize neither skull nor skin are boundaries for what you can say that system is made of, which is energy flow. And then suddenly you realize then you're at the place of the whole universe. And then even when you study physics, for example, you find there are two realms. There's a realm of large objects that Newton studied, and then there are the realm of small objects like electrons and photons that quantum physicists study. And when you look at the characteristics of those two realms, you start realizing that mental experience can dip into both realms. And people, when you realize that, whether you're going to try to understand psychotherapy using meditation or now the cutting edge of using psychedelics, to really deeply understand this, as Michael Pollan says in his last paragraph of his book, How to Change the Mind, maybe this has something to do with quantum physics. Well, I've written to Michael about this, but just to say it here, I think when you're open to looking at the mathematics of complex systems and the mathematics beneath quantum theory, and you take the first person reports of people doing meditative practices like the Wheel of Awareness in a systematic way, then as a scientist, you're invited to say, if the mind is an emergent property, which is the systems finding in math, coming out of the elements is another aspect beyond the singular elements. So the notion is that the mind is an emergent property of energy flow. Then you really need to go to the math. You need to go to physics. You need to understand how these molecules of chemistry study, work. How does it come together in a living being? So you study biology with neuroscience and genetics. And then you're saying, well, but it's about attention and emotion and memory. So then you study psychology. But we're doing this in groups. So you study sociology and we talk to each other with words. So you study linguistics. And the next thing you know is you're studying cultures in anthropology. And before you know it, you've got interpersonal neurobiology because you've gone from math to anthropology and everything in between. And then you say, and this is back in 1991, 92, you say, okay, how do we make this useful? Not just interesting. And when I wrote the first book of interpersonal neurobiology called The Developing Mind, Deborah Malmud called me up and said, I've read your book. How would you like to do a series of books? I said, well, this took a long time, like 8 years to write this book. I'm not going to do a series. No. She says, not a series of books that you write, but a book series where you're the editor, the founding editor, and you can pick other people to write the books. I said, what would it be about? She goes, anything you want. Whoa. I said, really? Then how about interpersonal neurobiology, which is what was proposed in the other book, which was not a Norton book. Anyway, and so she said, fine. And that's how it all came, because I saw the value in working with these 40 scientists of trying to find a common ground. And it's been thrilling, and if we just continue with these chapters, Dan Hill is a wonderful therapist in New York who writes a chapter called Dysregulation and Its Impact on States of Consciousness. So there you see this looking at regulation theory, and how we regulate essentially energy flow, but you could call it affect regulation, as Alan Shore beautifully does, and looking at how that affects these states of mind or states of consciousness, as Dan calls them. And that's also a great way of seeing where you can then articulate things about states, things about consciousness, things about regulation. And for a therapist reading that chapter, they're going to be grounded then in, oh, I see, this is what it means to have these executive functions that can work well for regulation or not work well for dysregulation. So then you compare Dan Hill's chapter to Lou Cozzolino and his colleagues' chapter. And then, and we've ordered these in this way. When you get to Pat Ogden's next chapter, which is called A Healing Context, Philosophical Spiritual Principles of Sensory Motor Psychotherapy. Pat is an incredible example of someone who deeply feels the commitment to helping people heal. And at the same time, she is committed to understanding ancient practices, for example, of mindfulness work, of looking at the body and how we get lost in our worded intellects sometimes, but to then make sure the body is front and center. And her sensory motor psychotherapy is a progressive training you can get to learn that. And her writing in all of her books, she's written a number of books in our series, you know, are really taken in a deep way, because a lot of us, including myself, you know, we're trained to do psychotherapy with a lot of talking and a lot of concepts.
Yeah.
But Pat brings it right down into the body, and these somatic-based therapies really help us get to what I think Alan Shore powerfully talks about and Dan Hill refers to in his chapter, you know, these ways in which the feelings that are before words, you know, how those can actually work. So Pat's chapter is fabulous, A Healing Context. Then Oliver Morgan writes on addiction recovery in a time of social distancing, again, referring to the pandemic. And what does it mean to be someone who's prone to addiction? You know, so we look deeply at the dopamine circuitry of the reward systems, and then understand how one of the most rewarding things is to have social contact. So what happens during a pandemic when we disconnect that way? Well, sadly, as the research is showing, huge increases in anxiety, depression, despair and isolation, suicide, and addiction. You know, yeah. So, you know, while this is a book that will, you know, last a long time, the pandemic has made these issues particularly timely. And that's why we're happy to have people talk about that. Then the last two chapters are Birds of a Feather by Terry Marks Tarlow, The Importance of Interpersonal Synchrony in Psychotherapy. And Terry is just this artistic, I want to call her like a magician, who's able to go deeply into fractals and the mathematics of systems and how they work together, and tie that into clinical intuition. So if you look at her book in our series, it's a really beautiful example of that. And this is the notion that when you look at a relationship in therapy, how there's synchrony is fundamental to how the client will be healing. And this synchrony allows, in many ways, a kind of resonance that is like two strings on a guitar. They don't become each other, but they're influencing each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I maybe emphasize especially a process called integration, which many people don't talk about. But for me, that's the heart of interpersonal neurobiology, is that complex systems achieve optimal self-organization when they both differentiate or allow things to be different, and they link. And that's the basis of basically the synergy of synchrony, that there's something greater than the individual parts. Yeah. That's the emergent property. Anyway, and then Dan Hughes, the final chapter, writes Synchronizing. So again, working with synchrony, we've put these dozen chapters in a flow so that you as the reader will experience a certain building of it. And Dan, who's this wonderful therapist, who's also a poet, and writes just beautifully. Dan Hughes writes, Synchronizing Neurological States of Emotion in Family Therapy While Online. So there again, we have a pandemic related shift in what we've had to do as therapists, where we're doing so much online therapy. And I myself have found, you know, all these things, but this idea of allowing yourself to synchronize. So for me, like what I've done with you, David, is I take the person I'm doing therapy with, I make my window in whatever platform it is smaller so that I can take the face of my client, my patient, put it right under my camera. So right now I'm actually looking into your eyes, David, on the screen. Does it feel like I'm looking at your eyes in reality?
Yeah, it does. And I'm wondering how you do that, because that always bothers me, because when I look back at the videos, it looks like I'm looking down.
You are.
Because the camera is high up on the Macintosh.
Right. No, I have a Mac too. So let's walk this through, because I've been noticing you've been looking down, and I wouldn't want to interpret that as shame if I were in therapy. So what I do with my clients, let's do it right now, is go to your window size, and this is for everyone listening. People should learn how to do this, and make it so it's not filling the whole screen.
It's relatively small.
Okay, now drag my image up above yours.
You are already there, actually.
I'm at the top?
Yeah.
Okay, now pull my head as close to your lens of your camera as possible.
Okay, I've just moved it up a little higher.
There you go. Is there anything you can do to make that window closer to your camera?
No, I wish there were. I'm using a 17-inch iMac all-in-one, and it's there's a separation between the camera and the window of about a couple inches.
Is my head pretty much underneath your lens?
Yeah, I've centered it that way.
And then look right in my face now. Just look right in my face.
Well, I'm looking at the camera. But
look at my face.
Okay, I'm looking at your face.
Okay, and I see it. On your system, it's a little low.
Yeah, I'm sure it looks like I'm looking down.
And there's no way to make it. Well, no, you know,
if I look at the camera, then it'll look like I'm looking at you.
Right.
And there was a software company out there, and I don't know if they got their product off the ground or not, who was working out a fix for that.
Yeah, you could do it by putting the camera behind the screen, of course, and have it just follow the face. But I don't know how you do that technology. But what I found is, because the brain absolutely can see if I were looking this way. Can you tell I'm not looking at you now?
Yeah, a little off.
Or if I look that way.
Yeah,
off to the side. But if you get pretty close to a vertical line of the face, and like if I just right now look toward your forehead, let's say, it probably looks like I'm looking right in your eyes, does it?
Yeah. Are you using a laptop?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, the camera is much on the bezel of the laptop. It's much closer than it is on the iMac.
Oh, I see, yeah. So this is something you can do, but for everyone listening, you know, the idea is to honor the brain has a way to detect where the fovea, where your eyes are actually looking. Uh-huh. And we use that because we're very social creatures. And you want to know, where is this person I'm with paying attention? And eye contact is not just a casual term. It's a big deal. If I go like this, you know, it's going to be a different session, you know, we're going to have. I actually had a patient where every time he would get really emotional, he'd look away. And so finally, I wanted to say something about it. I said, I wonder if you're feeling something like shame or something when you're looking away. He goes, what do you mean looking away? I said, you keep on looking down here. He goes, well, I'm looking right at you. I said, oh my God, where's your camera? He goes, I have no idea. So we spent some time and got him to put my head beneath his lens, and the whole thing changed.
Yeah, I have to concentrate on looking at the camera, which is hard to do because you're moving around a lot, and it's natural to look at you rather than to look at the camera, but you can't tell I'm looking at you.
Oh, of course. I just did 2 8-hour lectures for Brazil, and it was on this platform we're on now. And I was looking into a camera the whole time. It was a green screen. So I was also looking at, unfortunately, myself. But, you know, but you really have to almost imagine the person you're with. And that's different than therapy. Yeah. But I just want to say, you know, in terms of this book, what's so exciting about it is this kind of stuff is what is talked about in interpersonal neurobiology and clinical practice. When we think about the relational synchrony that many of our authors are writing about, how do you do that online, right? How do you actually use this way we keep contact in the face of a viral pandemic to actually even address these larger pandemics, which is the pandemic of isolation, the pandemic of social injustice, the pandemic of environmental destruction? You know, and I think in some ways, and I think I touch on this in the end of the chapter, and it's the whole topic of this book, which I'm trying to figure out how to put in a form that will be most useful. It's all a book about identity, you know, and in modern times, I think our culture has created an identity of separation that makes us have a view of what you can simply call a solo self, an isolated mm-hmm. self. So part of, I think, interpersonal neurobiology's potential is to say, what is the self? What is identity? What is belonging? And how do we take these features of what it means to be a human and say, how has modern culture given us a message that we're all separate, that may be at the heart of, you know, certainly worsening these pandemics, the way we don't collaborate with each other, but certainly at the basis of social injustice and racism, and even environmental destruction, where people see themselves as separate. So in the next 10 years, I think it's become pretty clear to everybody who thinks about this, that we have about 10 years to identify what humanity is doing wrong. And if we can use our skills as mental health professionals to help nudge cultural evolution in a more generative rather than degenerative way,
yeah.
a more integrative way rather than the chaos or rigidity that emerges when you block integration. So, you know, books can state something and they're not be all and end all, but in our series of books, what we try to do is provide some kinds of inroads. And in this chapter that I wrote for this book, and certainly in this next book called Intraconnected that I'm trying to get out into the world, you know, there, I think how culture in modern times defines itself as separate aligns with what indigenous teachings have taught for thousands of years, what contemplative, you know, meditative practices reveal, that ironically, when you sit alone on a cushion and meditate, you come to realize that the self that's sitting on the cushion is not just the body sitting there, that the self is all the people around you. The self is all of humanity. The self is all of nature. And if we started acting in a way that realizes these larger ways of viewing the self, then whether you're running a factory or running a family or just running your own personal inner life, you can start behaving in a way that realizes the intraconnection of the whole, and from a point of view of the part of the whole, interconnection, so that we can then run countries in a different way, run companies in a different way, run curricula in a different way. And we have about 10 years to do this. So if we don't do it,
yeah.
we're seeing with the fires and the hurricanes, the droughts, the floods, we're seeing, I mean, I just read the cover story of all the major newspapers that arrived at this house this morning, all three of them, you know, and it's like the most depressing thing you can imagine. So how do we move from states of depression to states of action and hope, where we can actually say, this is what we think the problem is, and this is what we can do about it. So, you know, I know this book is just one in, you know, so many books that are published. But in interpersonal neurobiology and clinical practice, I think mental health professionals have an opportunity to get a feeling for what these issues are and then practical ways to make a difference for the individual, for couples, for families, for, you know, young people, children, adolescents, for adults, and to work together to try to make this world more a kind and compassionate place yeah. for all of us now and for our descendants to come.
In your chapter alone, you really lay out such a huge vision that it seems to me you lay out a whole program of education. I'm wondering about education in psychology and so on going forward, and psychotherapy. I mean, this is a whole graduate school that you are, and maybe also an undergraduate's program
yeah.
that you're envisioning. And it's a tall order to, you know, that 10 years is a very short timeline, unfortunately, to have to pull it all together.
I know. You know, at the Mindset Institute, we have a kind of curriculum about this, and people come to try to learn from all walks of life. But the idea is we do have not to create a sense of panic, but to create a sense of collaborative belonging to a journey that we need to engage in now. Mm-hmm. This is not like, let's do a study of this and talk about it 50 years from now. We have to do this now. And 10 years may sound like a long time, but David, as you're pointing out, it's a short time.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a privilege to talk to you about it, because any way we can get the word out about key issues. And for me, the key issue is basically identity, that cultural messages of what's called self-construal, of individualism and separateness, mm-hmm. I think are at the heart of the destruction of life on Earth. Well, that's the absolute sad part of it. The good news is, if it's the human mind that's creating the self-construal of separation, mm-hmm. then it's the human mind that can turn this around. And the studies of self-control show you can turn it around pretty fast, actually. So that really was heartening for me to read the science of that and say, okay, so we just have to name it to frame it. You know, we've got to frame it in a picture that says, I see that picture of where we need to go. I'm already part of a team called mental health. And if the mind has been destroying the living systems of Earth, the mind can turn it around and preserve and love those systems. So, you know, I do work with Paul Hawken, and Paul's written this beautiful book called Regeneration. It's the follow-up of his book called Drawdown, about drawing down carbon emissions. You know, the work I do at the Garrison Institute is a nonprofit, you know, monastery of the 21st century, where we're trying to bring what we call, you know, timeless wisdom to timely action. Mm-hmm. And we have a bunch of fellows. You can go see what we do there with our fellowship. But the point of mentioning all these things is that while mental health starts with the individual, it doesn't end there. How can we have an expectation for mental health when our living systems are decaying and not sustaining life? So our job as mental health professionals has got to be environmental activists. You know, one of my great heroes and teachers is Joanna Macy. And Joanna beautifully tells us about how, yes, we need to have active hope, one of her really beautiful books. And we do that by being with the grief of what Glenn Albrecht, a professor down in Australia, you know, calls the earth emotions, feeling the grief of knowing that what used to exist no longer exists. The biodiversity that was here when you and I were kids, David,
yeah,
I know. It's gone.
Yeah.
This is not just, oh, I'm kind of a worry wart. You know, no, I mean, I was just with my daughter last night for dinner. She started her doctoral program in environmental science and engineering. And, you know, we were talking about this. We've known this a long, long time, these dangers. And my mom, who's 92, she said, why are we only now doing something about it? You know? And this is the issue. Like, we've known about this a long time. So if we really only have 10 years to turn it around, how do we ring out the bells and say, the good news about this is the path humanity was taking wasn't really good. It was good for a few, but it really wasn't good for the most. Now, if we shift the way the mind constructs itself, it's possible to actually create an incredible world that supports biodiversity, builds on indigenous wisdom, learns from contemplative practice, this timely wisdom. And this is something that we can do together. So, you know, I have a fun word that some people like and some people don't like it. It combines me and we into mui. But I do, whether you like it or not, the notion there from a science point of view is that I think we need to get an integrated identity, whatever you want to call it. It's just a fun way of remembering it as mui. You don't lose the individual me in your body, but you realize the we of your relationships with people and the whole planet is just as much a part of your identity and belonging as the body you were born into. And that this mui continues after this body is gone. And that will give us the energy to actually do the work that it's going to take to switch things around in 10 years, but then to allow them to sustain themselves long after these bodies are gone.
Well, this is a great message that you're delivering here, and probably a good place for us to wrap it up.
Shrink wrap.
With that charge. Yeah, shrink wrap it up with that charge. And it's, so I'll have a lot to say. I was going to walk you through all the details of your chapter and all, but it has so much packed into it.
Well, thank you. I hope I didn't distract you from your outline for our conversation.
No, well, this was needed. This was great. So I thank you. It's good to talk to you again, and Godspeed to you in your work and actively implementing, carrying out, inspiring your vision.
Thanks, David. Thanks. This is a joint effort, and I'm honored to be here with you and with everyone in the Norton series and everyone on the planet to work together to make this happen.
Yeah, we're all together in it. Even though I had previously interviewed today's guest, Daniel J. Siegel, MD, on two other occasions, I feel I got to know him better this time. Often it's during a crisis that we get to take the true measure of a person. His sense of urgency about our current national and global crisis brought home to me that he's not just a brilliant theorist, but also an open-hearted, emotionally available realist. Actually, I think he's both an idealist and a realist. He just might be one of the heroes of our time. In a period of around 20 years, along with other pioneering theorists, scientists, and clinicians drawn into his orbit, he's founded the field of interpersonal neural biology, or INBP, and become series editor of 75 or more books under the highly respected Norton Books imprint. The book we discuss in this interview, Interpersonal Neurobiology and Clinical Practice, is a collection of 12 papers, the first one of which is written by Dan. For our interview, I had intended to focus on his opening essay with only a brief gesture toward the other papers, but he, rather modestly, spent most of our time giving us a tour of the contributions of the other 11 chapters, highlighting the diversity of clinical applications they represent. So I'll take the opportunity here to focus a bit on Dan's initial chapter, which brilliantly lays out the scope of his vision. The title of that chapter is, quote, "A Consilient Approach to Personal, Public, and Planetary Flourishing," close quote. So right away, you get a sense of just how ambitious his enterprise is. In fact, the, quote, "consilient approach," close quote, refers to the fact that his ideas are based on and validated by conversations with scientists from a broad range of fields, including anthropology, sociology, linguistics, psychology, biology, chemistry, physics, and mathematics. Of these conversations, he lists around a dozen agreed-upon principles, each of which he expands upon. But I'll just replicate them here, since I think they are mostly self-explanatory. They function as chapter subheads, but I think they can stand alone, almost like aphorisms or affirmations. So here's the first one. Quote, "Mind is broader than the brain and bigger than the body," close quote. So I'll just pause a bit between each so that you can digest it. Next, quote, "Energy and information flow occurs within an individual and between the individual and the world of other people and the planet, the world of nature," close quote. Quote, "Mind involves at least four facets: subjective experience, consciousness, information processing, and self-organization. Close quote. Quote, one facet of mind can be defined in this way, an emergent, self-organizing, embodied, and relational process that regulates the flow of energy and information. Close quote. Quote, a healthy mind is one that cultivates integration within and between, close quote. Quote, mental unhealth emerges with impaired integration, close quote. Quote, relational and neural integration are mutually reinforcing, close quote. Quote, where attention goes, neural firing flows and neural connection grows, close quote. Quote, mind in its regulatory role both monitors and modifies energy and information flow, and these are learnable mindsight skills, close quote. Quote, the term mindsight can refer to the capacity to have insight into one's own inner state of energy flow, to sense that in others as empathy, and to modify that flow within and between toward integration. So from these few quotes, you can begin to get a feel for the broad outlines of INBP theory, which aims to be very holistic, systems-oriented, invoking ideas of energy flow, integration, and communication between parts and levels, and big enough to incorporate phenomena of mind, spirituality, and the cosmos. It's clear that Dan is not a small thinker. He's into the big picture without discarding the parts. We're talking systems within systems within systems, all the way down and all the way up. In this one chapter, there are lots more lists and acronyms like INBP, which refers to the whole theory as well as the books in which the theory is developed and elaborated. So two other acronyms in the chapter are shorthand for books or parts of the theory that are developed elsewhere. The other chapters in the book written by his INBP colleagues exemplify the diversity of applications Dan envisions, not only for clinical practice, but for organizations, educational systems, governments, community bodies, and so on. Several of the chapters highlight the reality of the pandemic and exemplify opportunities to work within its challenges. Indeed, Dan closed our interview with a sense of urgency, saying that we have only 10 years in which to turn our global crises around. This drove home to me that he's not a head-in-the-clouds theorist, unaware of the precipice upon which he and all of us stand. He urges us all to hopeful, courageous action. 10 years strikes me as a tiny window. Upon reflection, though, I must agree that the courageous action he calls us to is the only acceptable response.
Hi, this is Dr. Ralph Wilson. I wanted to let you know that I'm so impressed with your work that I literally tell every patient I see that they ought to log into shrinkwrapradio.com and get the latest in anything that's concerning what's going on in their life. You can find almost anything at Shrinkwrap Radio. And thanks for being there, Dave. I won't let you take a whole lot longer on this spot, but thanks, Dr. Dave. Bye for now.
Thank you, Dr. Ralph Wilson, for your long and wholehearted support of Shrinkwrap Radio. Thanks to new one-time donor Andrew Judd for your contribution. And of course, thank you to all you monthly supporters. Your regular donations mean so much to me personally and also help to support the regular expenses that the show incurs. Time once again to wrap it up. Thanks to return guest Dr. Daniel J. Siegel, one of three editors of the new Norton book on interpersonal neurobiology and clinical practice, for your inspired and inspiring work. Next time, my guest will be American actor, activist, author, poet, and Buddhist teacher Peter Coyote, who will regale us with stories from his long, varied, and spectacular career. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.